Waiting Helen R. Hull. Listen to and download free AI-generated audiobooks at 3ords.com. The Project Gutenberg ebook of Waiting. This ebook is for the use of anyone anywhere in the United States and most other parts of the world at no cost and with almost no restrictions whatsoever. You may copy it, give it away, or reuse it under the terms of the Project Gutenberg license included with this ebook or online at www.gutenberg.org. If you are not located in the United States, you will have to check the laws of the country where you are located before using this ebook. Title: Waiting, author: Helen R. Hull. Release date: August 1, 2026. Ebook: 79,250. Language: English. Original publication: New York, Mary Fanton Roberts, Inc., 1920. Other information and formats: www.gutenberg.org/ebook/79,250. Credits: Jen Sadowski. This book was produced from images made available by the Hathi Trust Digital Library. Asterisk start of the project GUTENBRG EBOOK Waiting. Waiting, Helen R. Hull. The Touchstone, Vol. 8 Feb. 1921 pp. 346-354, 394-397, when Anne Stevens in her early 40s reached the plane to which her life had climbed and looked back, along the path she had come, some half a dozen incidents stood out clearly defined. In their place along the path they had seemed no more prominent than many others, but from her final elevation much of the rest was lost, too vague, too hidden in underbrush to be visible. She remembered one still, white winter day. She must have been very young, for she was small enough to sit unobserved beneath the window bench in her father's workshop. Content, still and white as the day, filled her. She watched the colorless vibrations above the small rusty stove in the corner and sniffed the comforting air, thick with fresh paint and sawdust. Her father worked above her, humming under his breath. That feeling of content must have been his, too. Perhaps hers came from him. He was making something, a case, for the works of an old clock, she thought. Then the door flew open, and crisp, sharp as the winter air, her mother stood on the threshold, her blue eyes hard and snapping. "So you're out here, wasting your day, John Stevens, when you might be finding something useful to do." Her father stepped away from the bench so that his curly fair hair no longer caught the pale sun. He smiled apologetically. "Put away your rubbish and go help Johnny in the store. If you can't get work for every day for yourself, the least you could do as a man is to be of use to your son. Is that Anne now under the bench come into the house?" Her mother slammed the door and was gone, but the still content had fled. Anne crawled out, shaking the shaving curls from her hair. Her father fingered the polished boards on his bench and then picked up the tools. "It's the fun there is in making things. The only joy that is good. Women don't know it, the joy of making." Then there was a night, how much later Anne did not know, when she woke with her heart cold at the sound of her mother sobbing. She crept out to the head of the stairs to listen. "It's only that she isn't good enough for you, my Johnny, my firstborn. Johnny, I've worked my fingers to the bone for you, slaved. For you to give you what you desired, and you have no more love for me, your mother." And then a voice cajoling, caressing John, her oldest brother. "Now, mother, can't a man take a wife? A man has a mother, and he wants a wife too, doesn't he? Now, mother." Anne knew that her mother had thrown her arms about John's neck. She had always known that her mother loved John more than the rest of them. "Go your way," her mother's voice shrilled out. "You're cruel, stubborn, and set. Keep her away from me, I tell you. I'll hate her." "Now, mother, you wouldn't. I'm bringing her home for dinner this Sunday, and I'll show her what a mother I've got. You'll be used to the feeling by then. Leave me alone. I'll have no more to do with you." Anne had crawled hastily back to bed and had listened in the dark to the choking, sobbing breath of her mother as she climbed the stairs. Sunday, John's sweetheart had come to dinner, and Anne had waited, tortured, for something to break. Her mother's cheeks were bright between the smooth bands of her heavy hair, but John had thrown his arm over her shoulders and joked at his Marie, "See how you'll have to work to make up to me for leaving such a mother." And nothing had happened. Then there was the dreadful time after Pierce, the second brother, had come home from the West, where he had gone in search of gold and found only the seed of death, so that he lived but 3 days after he had come back. Anne felt the chill darkness of the house. It was as though the grave sod had been piled over them all. Her mother, coming into the house after the funeral, had stared for a moment at her father. Anne remembered her face distinctly. The skin had drawn tightly over the high cheekbones and temples, and a gray, dusty pallor lay upon it. She had gone into her room and locked the door. How many days had she stayed there? Anne heard her father begging outside the door, begging against that awful silence within. Finally, He had cried, crouching on the floor, cried like a little child. Then he had called out, "Unless you come out, Kate, I will bring my axe and chop down this damn door." Anne remembered the slow opening of the door, the dreadful pause while her mother stood above her father, staring down at him. She had said, "If part of my body was torn off, you would give it time to heal. And you cannot let me be." Suddenly, her father had taken her mother in his arms, and she was crying too. Anne had run away out of the house, another thing she remembered. She had been sitting in a crotch of the old apple tree at the side of the house, sewing for a doll. She had a family of dolls whom she tended carefully, without enthusiasm. As she sewed, a wonderful idea had seized her, gripping her heart with its splendor until she was dizzy. She had climbed down from the tree and gone in quest of her mother. She had found her in her low rocker, sewing, her eyes shining. One of her rare, light moods was upon her. Anne stood in front of her, trembling, eager. "Mother, will you, that is, I want? Well, don't stammer." How fast that little pricking sound of the needle ran. "Will you tell me, please, where I can get a baby? Of my own, I must have a baby." "What are you talking about?" Her mother dropped her sewing, wary suspicion in her eyes. "I want a baby." Anne found it difficult to say more. "Who has been telling you things you shouldn't know? Come here." Anne had shrunk away. "What are you talking about?" "Nothing, I just thought it, please, mother." She winced, under her mother's sharp grasp. "Have the children," her mother sighed. "Oh, you are so stubborn, don't shut your mouth that way. What has been said to you about babies?" "Nothing, nothing." Anne was hot with shame now, an inexplicable, harrowing shame. "Well, think nothing of them then. You're a baby yourself. Don't let me hear you talking of such things." Anne had played no more with dolls. One day at school, the teacher had said, "Now, children, let's all think what we want to be when we are grown up." She had gone round the class until she came to Anne. "Anne, do you want to be a milliner or a teacher, too?" Anne shook her head. "No, I want to be a mother." The sound of the laughter, sudden like thunder, rattled against her still. She had never spoken her desire again. After that came a stretch of years in which she made two discoveries. One was the magic of color and form. She could capture it with brush and paint, and the other was the extraordinary wonder of her own body. During the Christmas week of her last year in school, her class had a sleigh ride. She had gone reluctantly. The drive was a blur of sensations, chill air tingling in her nostrils, the smell and crackle of hay in the huge bobs, sharp bells on the horses, the crunch, under the runners, the yellow glow from the swinging lanterns. Songs and shouts and giggles, and then on the way home, silence with low whispers until the boy next to Anne had slipped his arm about her and pulled her close against him. Strange, maddening thrill, all ecstasy and sweet shame. She had never seen the boy again. He was a cousin of someone visiting, but the thrill became part of her dreams. There was one dream. Sometimes she could cling to it when she had wakened. Sometimes she knew only from the still, white peace with which she woke that she had dreamed it. She lay in a great meadow which curved against a blue sky under the sun. No wind stirred. She lay there, not as herself, but as the meadow, part of the quiet, waiting soil. In March of her year at the normal school, Anne met Robert Duffy. He had come over from the university for a short series of lectures. Anne had been unruffled by the comments upon him. He was the youngest man on the staff of the university, with a reputation of brilliance and the forecast of a great future. When he walked out on the platform, Anne in her corner leaned forward, the pupils of her eyes dilating. He was thin and dark, with hasty gestures, and a hostile eagerness sprang from his voice and eyes. At the end of his second lecture, Anne waited at the edge of the crowd about the platform. She proffered some question, simple, almost irrelevant, and as he answered her, stood near him, her brow, her beautiful throat, her relaxed fingers touched with subtle humility. After that, he watched for her, and Anne's daze leaped up like a ship at the flick of the wind. Robert Duffy may have thought he drove her down the seas before him. Anne knew he had not wished to marry so immediately. He was working for a degree, was developing a new chemical theory. But Anne, lifting his hands to clasp the pillar of her throat, had said calmly, "Why wait? You are tired and nervous now for someone to take care of you." In April, Anne was summoned home. Her mother had died suddenly. Her father wept for her as the young girl he had loved. And Anne, looking at the pale, oval face between the sleek, dark wings of her hair, saw her for the first time as a woman of passion and force caught in too narrow an orbit. The father went to live with John and his wife, and in June, Anne was married. She remembered only one thing her father had said. "I thought it might be now, Annie, you would make an artist." She had smiled and gone swiftly on with her preparations. Her mother's death had foreshortened life for her, until she felt at times a fear that she too might die with her desire unreached. One of the next years, there were two moments with sharp outlines, the rest blurred into full tide of passionate tenderness, fear, absorption. One moment was at night in that first summer. She and Robert walked along the river just outside the little college town, silent until Robert turned on her. "Where are you? I can't reach you," he had cried out. "I am afraid of you. You drown me and I never touch you. What are you doing with me?" She was glad of the darkness, which hid the sudden fierce contraction of her body, hid the terror and hatred that leaped within her. But she had laughed softly and said, "You are tired. You work too." Hard, until he lay with his head against her breast, her fingers in his, hair, while she stared with somber, heavy eyes at the pale glow on the water at her feet. She had been shamed at the coil of emotion his cry had struck, so that she had thrust the moment out of memory. The other sharp moment was shortly before the birth of her second child. She lay on the couch in the sitting room, staring dully at the dingy carpet, the litter of papers on the desk. Margaret, who slept in her arms, had stirred, and the touch of that silky head in the curve under Anne's chin drew her up from her apathy. Robert came to the door, and she knew the conflict she had waited for was upon her. "I understand you have talked with Samuels," Robert began. "You might have said so all this time. I thought you would wish to make your decision yourself." Robert slumped into a chair near the desk. She thought for the first time that she knew how he would look as an old man, the eagerness drained out of his dark face. "Samuels told you his offer, of course. I harness my brains to his chemical plant for life. He said there would be opportunity for you to carry on any experiments you wished." Her voice trailed off wearily, as though she had no spirit for a fight. "You'd like me to take it? Only if you wish." She pressed that small, silky head against her throat. "You know what I want, to go on my own path." He stopped. "Have you thought of the children? You give me small chance to think of anything else." She turned her face away from him, her eyes closed. Presently, he rose heavily. "Very well, have it your way." "No, Robert, you must decide. Are you so sure your own path leads anywhere?" She saw in his eyes the great weight of her own passive, inert body, of her gray immobility. "I was once, and I don't mean to be selfish." He flung out his hands with their slender, nervous fingers in a limp, impotent gesture. "Samuel's offer is profitable. I am taking it." "Why so tragic, Robert?" Her words hurried slightly. "Even if you leave your university for someone who appreciates your value, you'll still have time for your own work, evenings and all. Turn off an idea after dinner." He broke off into an ugly little laugh. "Have you no comprehension of the way creative work must be done? How you wait and wait while it grows within you? You can't just do it forcibly overnight. But I said I was taking Samuel's offer. I'll become his well-paid consulting chemist." When he had gone, Anne laid her lips gently against the fragrant, warm crease of Margaret's neck, her eyes closed to hide their triumph. After that, 10 years in which Anne had been as God walking in his garden. Her children were the miracle herself extended, beyond her own narrow limits, the work of her flesh and her spirit. In them she was fulfilled, and in their growth she saw her own work. Her passion was not that of the mother so much as that of the artist. She could have created pictures. Instead, she chose to create human beings. Robert begged her to spend less time with the children, to leave them, and she brushed his words carelessly aside. Almost overnight, it seemed Jamie, the youngest, was 4. Sandy-haired, chunky, jolly, and Margaret, 14, was a tall, slim thing with dark eyes and hasty gestures like her father. She developed stubborn, reticent moments, against which Anne thrust herself vainly. Anne's first jealousy licked through her veins when she saw Margaret. After a long afternoon curled up with a book, silent, almost sullen at Anne's approach, fling aside book and mood at her father's homecoming. Anne heard them in the library, Margaret's light voice, courting with Robert's tone. She went to the door, shaken with a forlorn desire to beg them to admit her, but pride held her outside. The sound of those voices, however, stood out as the first, faint, rumble in Anne's clear sky. It was ridiculous of Robert to take the child so seriously, to talk with her as though she were a grown person, she thought. She added hastily, a surface thought, "Of course, I want the children to be real friends with their father. It's only that he's spoiling her." Margaret came in from school one day, her eyes alight. "Mother, the girls are going to Miss Truesdell's camp this summer. Could I go?" Anne asked which girls were going and added gently, "Mother would rather have her girl with her." "Oh, mother," cried Margaret, and then was silent, her whole slight figure stiffening into protest. "Wouldn't you rather stay with mother?" Margaret lifted her dark eyes, and Anne had a sudden impulse to seize her, to shake out of her the hostility that lay within her glance. But she said, with her persistent gentleness, "At any rate, I should have to know more of the camp before I could decide." At the sight of Margaret rushing down to meet her father that evening, Anne's decision clicked into shape. She would send the child to the camp. It would, after all, be excellent training, with the regularity of the life and all. Margaret had been growing too fast and perhaps studying too hard. She was over-emotional, Margaret came back after 2 months in the mountains, brown, slim, apparently docile. Anne had moved her household to the shore, near enough town so that Robert could spend weekends with them. The second week of Margaret's return, Anne discovered that her casual manner of wandering down the road in the early afternoon had a definite motive. She went to intercept the postman. Anne's first thought was one of horror. Had a silly flirtation started? Surely Margaret was too young for that. She was only a little girl. The next afternoon, Anne followed with swift, silent feet when she saw Margaret start down the lane. She found her on a bench, near the tennis court, her dark head and slim brown throat bent over. A letter. Oh, she is beautiful, thought Anne. This young girl child of mine, I won't have her touched, not yet. At her feet on the gravel, Margaret crumpled the letter into her pocket and flung back her head, scarlet running into the tan of her cheeks. A letter, said Anne as she sat down beside Margaret. How nice. Margaret slipped to the end of the bench, in her bright eyes something, fluttered desperately, seeking escape. Who is writing to you? Anne kept her voice gentle in spite of the inflexible impulse behind her words. As Margaret rose, poised at the edge of flight, she added, If I weren't sure of you, Margie, I should think you were hiding something you were ashamed of. She saw the girl flinch. It's nothing, she protested. Just from a friend from Miss Insmere at the camp. Won't you show me her letter? Anne sat very quiet. She stretched out one firm white hand toward Margaret, and her face showed nothing of the sharp fear that circled within her. Was Margaret lying to her? You see, Mother doesn't know her. It's just a letter to me. The girl's hands clenched over her pocket, and she retreated a step. Anne rose deliberately and laid her fingers on the girl's wrist. She was taller than Margaret. The child was a reed she could bend in, her fingers. But the quiver of the wrist under her fingers disturbed her, and unexpectedly, she was aghast at the flame of defiance that leapt in the dark pupils of the girl's eyes. In that moment, Margaret wrenched her wrist free, and with a fierce OH, was running across the tennis court toward the shore. At luncheon, Anne felt Margaret's eyes touch her warily. She paid no heed. Once, when Margaret was a mere baby, she had been stubborn, and Anne, by quiet ignoring of her, had brought her swiftly to her arms in hot tears. Then she knew that she must see that letter. Quickly she went, along the hall to Margaret's room. She must protect the child. There lay the child's dress, but her fingers found no letter in the pocket. She stood in front of the little white desk, with a faint smile at the tiny yellow shells laid in a row along the top, and the flat, bleached sand dollars, one at each corner of the blue blotter. Just a child, after all. Like a distant echo, Anne felt the slow rhythm of the days before Margaret's birth, when all her life had turned inward, dream-woven, too, the making of this child. There, in one of the pigeonholes, were the letters. Anne hesitated. Margaret need never know. There seemed no other way. She brushed aside the strange qualm and drew out the letters, several of them, addressed to Miss Margaret Duffy in a bold, square hand. Frieda Insmere, Truesdell Camp, on the flap. At least the child hadn't lied. She had the folded sheet in her fingers when behind her she heard a little strangled cry, and turning, she faced Margaret. She made an instinctive motion of concealment, but the envelope slipped to the floor. For an instant, as the wide, incredulous horror of Margaret's gaze traveled from that white square up to her mother's face, Anne shared that horror as though she saw her guilty reflection in the girl's dark, stormy eyes. Only for an instant. Then she spoke crisply. I am sorry, Margaret, but if you insist upon concealment, it is necessary for me to do this. Margaret stood motionless, a little figure of bronze, save for her quick breathing. Perhaps you came back to hide these letters, Anne added cruelly. She saw the adorable young curves of shoulder and knee melt from bronze to trembling flesh. Unless you are ashamed, Margie, why do you hide them from Mother? Her voice filled again with its soft, rich tones. Come, sit here beside me and tell me about this new friend. Margaret shrank away from her outstretched hands, retreated along the end of the bed, clinging to the footrail, her knuckles showing white through the tan. Oh, you shouldn't touch them, she cried out. They are mine, and you shouldn't touch them. Margaret, dear, Mother wants only what is best for you. You know that. This woman has made you secretive, ashamed. I'm not ashamed. Margaret's lips struggled with tears. Anne lifted the sheet and unfolded it. With a swift movement, Margaret was in front of her. If you read that, I'll hate you, she cried. Anne dropped the letter and pulled the girl into her warm embrace. Margie, little Margie, you are my daughter, flesh of my flesh, spirit of my spirit. I won't have a stranger standing between us. She felt the child's tears on her throat, felt her body stiffen within her arms. I shall not read those letters against your will, but you will bring them to me. She went slowly from the room. She turned at the door. Margaret stood motionless, her head averted. Something in her posture tore at Anne like a rending of flesh from flesh. A strange fear hurried at her heels down the hall. Later, she knew what that pain and fear had been. Worse than birth anguish, they were the labor pains of her new knowledge. Anne took her sewing down to the screened porch. She had discovered years earlier that whenever life snarled itself up, she had only to sit down with something in her hands, something requiring attention, and gradually, without effort on her part, things would smooth themselves out. So she sat now, her fingers busy with bright orange wool with which she embroidered a blouse for Margaret. Finally, she heard Jamie wake and scramble off in search of his brother. Then she heard within the house Margaret's voice, clear with delight, "Father, I didn't know you were coming today." Anne laid aside her sewing with a secret, faint dismay, which she banished instantly. She found Robert in the hall. Margaret, hanging over the banister, drew back at Anne's approach. "Hello, Anne." Robert kissed the cool cheek Anne offered. "The city was so beastly I came out a day early. Had your swim, Margie? Fine, I want to see that new dive you wrote about." "I'll wait for you down by the boathouse," said Margaret, and she whisked down the stairs and out of the door. "Don't let her stay in the water too long, Robert," said Anne. "She seems tired, and bring the boys back when you come." Anne went slowly back to her sewing. A faint disturbance lingered under her ignoring concentration on the orange stitches. Dinner was rather silent in spite of Anne's gentle and insistent talk. Margaret and her father had come in just in time to dress. Margaret had twisted her damp hair on the crown of her head and bound it with a green ribbon, that with her green linen. Dress gave her small pointed face with its winged brows the look of a startled dryad. Anne glanced at her often. There hung about her a cloud of excitement like light over water. Once she found Robert, too, eyeing her speculatively. When Anne came down from Jamie, good night, she found the porch deserted. Little Robert came back presently, somewhat disconsolate because Dad and Margie were taking a long walk and didn't want him. He sat beside Anne, telling her in his shrill young voice of all he had done since morning. She sent him to bed finally, and at his summons, climbed the stairs to bid him good night. As she descended, she heard Margaret and her father at the door. "Good night, Bobs," Margaret was saying. "And you'll tell her, oh, Bobs, if you'll promise to go straight to sleep and get unstrung a little. Good night, Margie." Margaret's flight up the stairs carried her past her mother before she saw her. "Good night, dear," called Anne. Margaret hesitated. World came back the few steps, lifting her face mutely toward Anne. "Good night, mother's little girl." Anne kissed her wistfully. "Sleep well." Again, at Margaret's hasty withdrawal, she felt that strange fear. But she went calmly down to the porch where Robert waited. "Have you time to talk a while?" he asked abruptly, and she heard in his voice an excitement like Margaret's. He waited until she had settled herself in a low chair and then dropped opposite her against a pillar. He lighted a cigar, the light glowing within his fingers. "Are you very tired this week?" she asked. "Nothing unusual," he dismissed her inquiry brusquely. "I want to talk about Margaret." Had the child gone to her father tail-bearing, that would be unendurable. "She's been telling me things." Robert paused. "She didn't tell you about her letters?" Anne spoke with frigid scorn. "Letters, no." "Well," Anne waited, the autumn dusk wrapping her in outward tranquility. "The beginning, I suppose, is a call I had last week. I thought I wouldn't write about it. A Miss Insmere came into the office one day. She was at this camp where you sent Margaret, a dancing teacher. Quite a person, too, I judge, young, vigorous, a Danish girl. She came in about Margaret, thinks the child has a talent for dancing." "Why did she go to you?" Anne found it difficult to keep her voice from bristling. "Because you weren't in town, I suppose. She seemed to think we wouldn't take to the idea, and so she came to talk it over." "What idea?" Anne's antagonism rippled in her tone. "Why, of Margaret's dancing. She thinks she ought to study, Margie, I mean, on the side for a few years, then she'll know whether it's the thing, and Margie wants to—"
"You mean study dancing professionally?"
"Yes." "Ridiculous. I hope you told her we had our own plans for Margaret." "Now, wait a minute, Anne. You see, Margaret has been talking to me, too. She wants to do it. You haven't encouraged her." "I have listened to her, Anne. Why hasn't she come to me about this?" Anne shut her hands together in her lap. "The letters, they were about this scheme. Can't you see? She is afraid you will disapprove, afraid she can't make you see how much she wishes to try it. She knows it is absurd, then, if she is so sure of my disapproval." "Is it, Anne? Why? A public dancer. That child? Are you mad, Robert?" Margaret said to me tonight, and she didn't sound childlike that she thought she had to dance. "She studied last year, you know, at school. She says, and you know how shy she is with words, that it is the only thing she loves, that she can say things she feels and thinks that way. That she feels as though she has just been waiting until she found this out. We walked down through the black firs tonight, and she danced for me, a dance she had made for the trees, she said. Anne, it was the loveliest dream I ever saw." Anne was silent, her hands moved together up to her heart as if to hold close the edges of a gaping wound.
After the grief of the afternoon Margaret had taken her father away to dance for him, Margaret was afraid to come to her. "You know, Anne," went on Robert eagerly, "I have a strong belief that a desire, like that is, well, sort of sacred, that we haven't any business to stand in the way, don't you think so?" "She's only a child," said Anne coldly. "She doesn't really know what she wants." "I'm not so sure." "I knew what I wanted earlier than that, didn't you?" "I didn't get it." His voice dropped wryly. "That's no reason why Margaret shouldn't. Surely, Robert, you don't believe what you are saying, that a child knows better what it needs than its mother, its parents, can know? Ah, Anne, we don't know much. If this isn't the right thing, she has plenty of time to find it out." Robert pulled himself to his feet, drew a chair near Anne, and seated himself. "You think, probably, that I don't appreciate how this makes you feel. Shall I tell you? You are feeling as though a picture you had started to paint suddenly walked off your canvas." He puffed strongly at his cigar, and the momentary glow touched into relief his cheekbones and temples, lighted his eyes with a glimmer of their old eagerness. They were Margaret's eyes, the same pointed fold of eyelids, the same dark fire. What had he said? A picture walking off the canvas. "I wonder why I said picture," he went on slowly out of the darkness. "I must have been thinking of that career you might have taken. You chose children instead, and human beings aren't so docile as paint and canvas, are they?" "Why discuss that?" Anne moved impatiently. "You must admit that I have no interests, no concern, except the good of the children. That's why I won't consent to this plan. You've been wheedled into it by a strange woman and a child. I think it rather unjust of you to encourage Margaret without consulting me." "Don't be hasty, Anne. There are so many things I'd like to say tonight." He flicked his cigar end over the railing. "You've no idea how much thinking I have done this week. It began after Miss Insmere call. Then young Carstyle came in. Remember him? That boy at the university, he has carried through several of the things we started and more of his own. He was telling me about them. When he left, he grinned at me and said, 'They've got you properly domesticated and successful, haven't they, Duffy?' He was a little shabby in that gilt-edged office where I sit all day." Anne caught her breath sharply. "You are suggesting, I suppose, that I am to blame for your commercialization?" she asked, incredulity in her cool tone. "I want to show you how I feel about Margie. I know why she is afraid to come to you with her desires. You are indomitable. Anne, you are like the earth itself. No one sees its motion, but no one can stop it, and everyone is whirled along with it. Sometimes I have known that you chose me. Shall we say to father your children for you? Sometimes I have pretended I was a free agent. Sometimes I have been sorry you didn't devour me utterly. The female spider has a neat way with her spouse. You know I shouldn't say these things now, when it is all too late, except for Margaret. She doesn't want to be eaten. The boys are still too young to mind. How can you sit there and say those things?" Anne's voice was thick with whirling rage. "As though I were a monster. Anne, dear, you insist upon misunderstanding me. You have been a very beautiful mother, that I know. I am not blaming you that I am prosperous and respectable instead of lean and hollow-eyed from wrestling with ideas and schemes. There was at least a motive there. The children did need food and shelter, but Margaret is no longer a baby. She must have what she wants." Something snapped in Anne, and a terrible, grinding pain, a physical anguish seized her. She huddled back in her chair, her hands pressing against her breasts. "Oh, you can't know," she cried. "You think I am selfish, devouring? You can't know. Before she was born, I dreamed of her beauty and health and loveliness. And since she was a baby, I have watched her, worked to make her what she is. A dancer in public, you have tried to get her away from me. You have tried. Anne, you know that is a lie. I have been humble enough that she has cared for me. When I saw her dancing tonight, I was jealous to frenzy that others might watch that. But if she wishes it, who are we to stand in her way? She doesn't know. She doesn't need to dance to do anything. I had planned so many things for years to come. Surely if I have made her what she is, I have a right to decide what she shall be. Made her." Robert sat forward. Anne could see his shoulders hunched against the dim light through the window behind him. "We like to think that, don't we? Instead, I was a tool for you, and you, even you, Anne, were a tool for what? An obscure drive of peoples behind us, craving embodiment. What have you made about her? When she was born, you felt you had created her. What had you done but wait, wait, while she grew?" He was silent. On the shore below them, Anne heard the steady rhythm of the surf, like a great crowd shouting in the distance. What had she done but wait, but wait? The words slipped into the rhythm of the surf. "You know," Robert's voice dropped into a puzzled wonder, "that's what all creative work seems to amount to. You wait, you think you are making something, but you only wait while it grows." Another silence. "I have filled my days so full I had no time for that slow waiting. Do you see, Anne, we are nothing but the soil lying fallow under the sun." Anne sat very still. The dreadful rending, within her had ceased and a heavy, lethargic cessation of pain like that after childbirth brooded over her. Incredibly there hung about her a moment of white peace, like that of her old dream in which she lay in the great windless meadow curving against the sky part of the waiting. Soil, Robert had spoken the truth. Margaret's struggles had been only an inarticulate expression of the same truth. It had been as though the soil tried to drag under its warm darkness a flower opening above. Robert rose and stood near her. "That's all, Anne." She felt his fingers brush her shoulder. "After all, you are an artist. Perhaps you should have chosen otherwise than children for your work." Anne could not speak. Humility, a strange garment for her, enclosed her. "It is late. Perhaps tomorrow after you have slept on it." He pulled his tone back to an ordinary level. "You are cold." She had shivered under his fingers. "No, only stripped." Her laugh trembled into a sob. "Won't you come in now?" "Not yet, please." A moment of hesitating. Silence, and Robert moved toward the door. "Robert?" Anne found words with cumbersome difficulty. "It may be that tomorrow I can thank you." She saw him draw his body erect as though a weight had dropped from him. "Good night." She sat for a long time like one who accustoms himself to the thin, clear air of a mountain top. She had reached the plateau, from which she could see the winding of the path she had followed. When, at last, she climbed silently to her room, she slept with the exhaustion which follows bodily suffering. She woke early, lying for a time with her eyes closed. Then she rose, and with a curious feeling of exaltation, as though she prepared herself for a sacrament, she wound her long braids of dark hair about her head and bathed. She could hear Jamie and little Rob, their tongues clattering in small, boy early morning style, but no one else seemed awake. She dressed carefully, choosing a dull blue crepe morning gown that Margaret had always liked. Then she went to Margaret's door and knocked. After a silent moment, she pushed it ajar. Margaret stirred sleepily, her face flushed and young in a cloud of dusky hair. At the sight of Anne, she woke instantly, and the wistful alertness in her eyes wrenched at Anne's poise. She sat down on the edge of the bed, her hands clasped, her eyes caressing the sweet curve of the child's body beneath the cover. "Margie, dear," she said, "Father talked over with me your plans." She saw terror leap in the girl's eyes, but she kept her voice serene. "I shall be glad to have you study dancing. Will you someday show me some of your own dances?" Margaret's eyes widened and a flame ran into her cheeks. "Oh," she cried. "Oh, I thought you wouldn't like it." She sat up against her pillow. "I must tell you," a bewildered shame in her face, "that I burned up those letters yesterday. They were just about the dancing. I am sorry about the letters." Anne, serenity had a tinge of piteousness. "Margaret, can you understand how hard it is to find your baby has grown up? I am sorry." Margaret brushed away the episode impetuously. "You really mean that you are glad about the dancing?" Her slim hand moved shyly along the blanket toward her mother. "You are glad?" The reticent caress winged into Anne, heart. "Yes," she said steadily. "I wanted to tell you to begin your day." She stood for an instant beside the bed before she turned to leave. In that instant, she had her vision of further waiting, a waiting into which Margaret might some day return. Transcriber's notes, transcribed from the first publication in The Touchstone, Vol. 8, Feb. 1921, pp. 346-354, 394-397, new original cover art included with this ebook is granted to the public domain. The original spelling and punctuation were preserved. Minor typesetting mistakes were silently corrected. End of the project. GUTMBRGEBOOK waiting asterisk. Updated editions will replace the previous one. The old editions will be renamed. Creating the works from print editions not protected by U.S. copyright. Law means that no one owns a United States copyright in these works, so the foundation and you can copy and distribute it in the United States without permission and without paying copyright royalties. Special rules set forth in the general terms of use part of this license apply to copying and distributing project Gutenberg trademark electronic works to protect the project GUTMBRGTM concept and trademark. Project Gutenberg is a registered trademark and may not be used if you charge for an ebook, except by following the terms of the trademark license, including paying royalties for use of the Project Gutenberg trademark. If you do not charge anything for copies of this ebook, complying with the trademark license is very easy. You may use this ebook for nearly any purpose, such as creation of derivative works, reports, performances, and research. Project Gutenberg ebooks may be modified and printed and given away. You may do practically anything in the United States with ebooks not protected by U.S. copyright law. Redistribution is subject to the trademark License, especially commercial redistribution. Start. Full license. The full project GUTM-BRGTM license. Please read this before you distribute or use this work. To protect the Project Gutenberg trademark mission of promoting the free distribution of electronic works by using or distributing this work, or any other work associated in any way with the phrase Project Gutenberg, you agree to comply with all the terms of the full Project Gutenberg license available with this file or online at www.gutenberg.org/license. Section 1. General Terms of Use and Redistributing Project Gutenberg Electronic Works. 1A. By reading or using any part of this Project Gutenberg electronic work, you indicate that you have read, understand, agree to, and accept all the terms of this license and intellectual property. Trademark Copyright Agreement. If you do not agree to abide by all the terms of this agreement, you must cease using and return or destroy all copies of Project Gutenberg electronic works in your possession. If you paid a fee for obtaining a copy of or access to a Project Gutenberg electronic work and you do not agree to be bound by the terms of this agreement, you may obtain a refund from the person or entity to whom you paid the fee as set forth in paragraph 1E8, 1B. Project Gutenberg is a registered trademark. It may only be used on or associated in any way with an electronic work by people who agree to be bound by the terms of this agreement. There are a few things that you can do with most Project Gutenberg electronic works, even without complying with the full terms of this agreement. See paragraph 1C below. There are a lot of things you can do with Project Gutenberg electronic works if you follow the terms of this agreement and help preserve free future access to Project Gutenberg electronic works. See paragraph 1E below. 1C. The Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation. Foundation, or PGLAF, owns a compilation copyright in the collection of Project Gutenberg electronic works. Nearly all the individual works in the collection are in the public domain in the United States. If an individual work is unprotected by copyright law in the United States and you are located in the United States, we do not claim a right to prevent you from copying, distributing, performing, displaying, or creating derivative works based on the work as long as all references to Project Gutenberg are removed. Of course, we hope that you will support the Project Gutenberg mission of promoting free access to electronic works by freely sharing Project Gutenberg works in compliance with the terms of this agreement for keeping the Project Gutenberg name associated with the work. You can easily comply with the terms of this agreement by keeping this work in the same format with its attached full Project Gutenberg license when you share it without charge with others. 1D. The copyright laws of the place where you are located also govern what you can do with this work. Copyright laws in most countries are in a constant state of change. If you are outside the United States, check the laws of your country in addition to the terms of this agreement before downloading, copying, displaying, performing, distributing, or creating derivative works based on this work or any other Project Gutenberg work. The Foundation makes no representations concerning the copyright status of any work in any country other than the United States. 1E. Unless you have removed all references to Project Gutenberg. 1E1. The following sentence with active links to or other immediate access to the full Project Gutenberg license must appear prominently whenever any copy of a Project Gutenberg work, any work, on which the phrase Project Gutenberg appears or with which the phrase Project Gutenberg is associated is accessed, displayed, performed, viewed, copied, or distributed. This ebook is for the use of anyone anywhere in the United States and most other parts of the world at no cost and with almost no restrictions whatsoever. You may copy it, give it away, or reuse it under the terms of the Project Gutenberg trademark license included with this ebook or online at www.gutenberg.org. If you are not located in the United States, you will have to check the laws of the country where you are located before using this ebook. 1E2. If an individual Project Gutenberg electronic work is derived from texts not protected by U.S. copyright law, does not contain a notice indicating that it is posted with permission of the copyright holder, the work can be copied and distributed to anyone in the United States without paying any fees or charges. If you are redistributing or providing access to work with the phrase Project Gutenberg associated with or appearing on the work, you must comply either with the requirements of paragraphs 1E1 through 1E7 or obtain permission for the use of the work and the Project Gutenberg trademark as set forth in paragraphs 1E8 or 1E9. 1. E3. If an individual project Gutenberg electronic work is posted. With the permission of the copyright holder, your use and distribution must comply with both paragraphs 1E1 through 1E7 and any additional terms imposed by the copyright holder. Additional terms will be linked to the Project Gutenberg license for all works posted with the permission of the copyright holder found at the beginning of this work. 1. E4. Do not unlink or detach or remove the full Project Gutenberg license terms from this work or any files containing a part of this work or any other work associated with Project Gutenberg. 1. E5. Do not copy, display, perform, distribute, or redistribute this electronic work or any part of this electronic work without prominently displaying the sentence set forth in paragraph 1E1 with active links or immediate access to the full terms of the project, Gutenberg license. 1. E6. You may convert to and distribute this work in any binary, compressed, marked up, non-proprietary or proprietary form, including any word processing or hypertext form. However, if you provide access to or distribute copies of a Project Gutenberg work in a format other than plain vanilla ASCII or other format used in the official version posted on the official Project Gutenberg website, www.gutenberg.org, you must at no additional cost, fee, or expense to the user provide a copy, a means of exporting a copy, or a means of obtaining a copy upon request of the work in its original plain vanilla ASCII or other form. Any alternate format must include the full Project Gutenberg license as specified in paragraph 1E1, 1, E7. Do not charge a fee for access to viewing, displaying, performing, copying, or distributing any Project Gutenberg works, unless you comply with paragraph 1E8 or 1E9, 1, E8. You may charge a reasonable fee for copies of or providing access to or distributing Project Gutenberg electronic works, provided that you pay a royalty fee of 20% of the gross profits you derive from the use of Project Gutenberg works calculated using the method you already use to calculate your applicable taxes. The fee is owed to the owner of the Project Gutenberg trademark, but he has agreed to donate royalties under this paragraph to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation. Royalty payments must be paid within 60 days following each date on which you prepare or are legally required to prepare your periodic tax returns. Royalty payments should be clearly marked as such and sent to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation at the address specified in Section 4, Information about donations to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation. You provide a full refund of any money paid by a user who notifies you in writing or by email within 30 days of receipt that he does not agree to the terms of the full Project Gutenberg trademark license. You must require such a user to return or destroy all copies of the works possessed in a physical medium and discontinue all use of and all access to other copies of Project Gutenberg trademark works. You provide, in accordance with paragraph 1F3, a full refund of any money paid for a work or a replacement copy if a defect in the electronic work is discovered and reported to you within 90 days of receipt of the work. You comply with all other terms of this agreement for free distribution of Project Gutenberg trademark works. 1. E9. If you wish to charge a fee or distribute a Project Gutenberg trademark electronic work or group of works on different terms than are set forth in this agreement, you must obtain permission in writing from the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation, the manager of the Project Gutenberg trademark. Contact the foundation as set forth in section 3 below, 1F1F1. Project Gutenberg volunteers and employees expend considerable effort to identify, do copyright research on, transcribe, and proofread works not protected by U.S. copyright law in creating the Project Gutenberg trademark collection. Despite these efforts, Project Gutenberg trademark electronic works and the medium on which they may be stored may contain defects, such as, but not limited to, incomplete, inaccurate, or corrupt data, transcription errors, a copyright or other intellectual property infringement, a defective or damaged disk or other medium, a computer virus or computer codes that damage or cannot be read by your equipment. 1F2. Limited warranty disclaimer of damages, except for the right of replacement or refund described in paragraph 1F3, the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation, the owner of the project. Gutenberg Trademark Trademark, and any other party distributing a project. Gutenberg Trademark Electronic Work under this agreement, disclaim all. Liability to you for damages, costs, and expenses, including legal fees. You agree that you have no REMEDIAS for negligence, strict. Liability, breach of warranty or breach of contract, except those provided in paragraph 1F3. You agree that the foundation, THE, trademark owner, and any distributor under this agreement will not be liable to you for actual, direct, indirect, consequential, punitive or incidental damages, even if you give notice of the possibility of such damage. 1F3. Limited right of replacement or refund. If you discover a defect in this electronic work within 90 days of receiving it, you can receive a refund of the money, if any, you paid for it by sending a written explanation to the person you received the work from. If you received the work on a physical medium, you must return the medium with your written explanation. The person or entity that provided you with the defective work may elect to provide a replacement copy in lieu of a refund. If you received the work electronically, the person or entity providing it to you may choose to give you a second opportunity to receive the work electronically in lieu of a refund. If the second copy is also defective, you may demand a refund in writing, without further opportunities to fix the problem. 1F4. Except for the limited right of replacement or refund set forth in paragraph 1F3, this work is provided to you as is with no other WRENTIS of any kind, express or implied, including but not limited to WRENTIS of MERC Chanti BLATY or fitness for any purpose. 1F5. Some states do not allow disclaimers of certain implied warranties or the exclusion or limitation of certain types of damages. If any disclaimer or limitation set forth in this agreement violates the law of the state applicable to this agreement, the agreement shall be interpreted to make the maximum disclaimer or limitation permitted by the applicable state law. The invalidity or unenforceability of any provision of this agreement shall not void the remaining provisions. 1F6. Indemnity. You agree to indemnify and hold the foundation, the trademark owner, any agent or employee of the foundation, anyone providing copies of Project Gutenberg trademark electronic works in accordance with this agreement, and any volunteers associated with the production, promotion, and distribution of Project Gutenberg trademark electronic works, harmless from all liability, costs, and expenses, including legal fees that arise directly or indirectly from any of the following which you do or cause to occur: a distribution of this or any Project Gutenberg work, b alteration, modification, or additions or deletions to any Project Gutenberg work, and c any defect you cause. Section 2. Information about the mission of Project Gutenberg. Project Gutenberg is synonymous with the free distribution of electronic works in formats readable by the widest variety of computers, including obsolete, old, middle-aged, and new computers. It exists because of the efforts of hundreds of volunteers and donations from people in all walks of life. Volunteers and financial support to provide volunteers with the assistance they need are critical to reaching Project Gutenberg goals and ensuring that the Project Gutenberg collection will remain freely available for generations to come. In 2001, the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation was created to provide a secure and permanent future for Project Gutenberg and future generations. To learn more about the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation and how your efforts and donations can help, see Sections 3 and 4 and the Foundation Information page at www.gutenberg.org, Section 3. Information about the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation. The Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation is a nonprofit 501(c)(3) educational corporation organized under the laws of the state of Mississippi and granted tax-exempt status by the Internal Revenue Service. The foundation's EIN or federal tax identification number is 64622-1541. Contributions to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation are tax-deductible to the full extent permitted by U.S. federal laws and your state's laws. The foundation's business office is located at 41 Watchung Plaza 516, Montclair, NJ 7042, USA, +1-862-621-9288. email contact links, and up. To-date contact information can be found at the Foundation's website. An official page at www.gutenberg.org/contact. Section 4. Information about donations to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation. Project Gutenberg trademark depends upon and cannot survive without widespread public support and donations to carry out its mission of increasing the number of public domain and licensed works that can be freely distributed in machine-readable form accessible by the widest array of equipment, including outdated equipment. Many small donations, $1 to $5,000, are particularly important to maintaining tax-exempt status with the IRS. The Foundation is committed to complying with the laws regulating charities and charitable donations in all 50 states of the United States. Compliance requirements are not uniform, and it takes a considerable effort, much paperwork, and many fees to meet and keep up with these requirements. We do not solicit donations in locations where we have not received written confirmation of compliance. To send donations or determine the status of compliance for any particular state, visit www.gutenberg.org/donate. While we cannot and do not solicit contributions from states where we have not met the solicitation requirements, we know of no prohibition against accepting unsolicited donations from donors in such states who approach us with offers to donate. International donations are gratefully accepted, but we cannot make any statements concerning tax treatment of donations received from outside the United States. U.S. laws alone swamp our small staff. Please check the Project Gutenberg web pages for current donation methods and addresses. Donations are accepted in a number of other ways, including checks, online payments, and credit card donations. To donate, please visit www.gutenberg.org/donate, Section 5. General information about Project Gutenberg Electronic Works. Professor Michael S. Hart was the originator of the Project Gutenberg concept of a library of electronic works that could be freely shared with anyone. For 40 years, he produced and distributed Project Gutenberg ebooks with only a loose network of volunteer support. Project Gutenberg ebooks are often created from several printed editions, all of which are confirmed as not protected by copyright in the U.S. unless a copyright notice is included. Thus, we do not necessarily keep ebooks in compliance with any particular paper edition. Most people start at our website, which has the main PG search facility, www.gutenberg.org. This website includes information about Project Gutenberg, including how to make donations to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation, how to help produce our new ebooks, and how to subscribe to our email newsletter to hear about new ebooks. This is the end of the audiobook. Thank you for listening. You can listen to and download more audiobooks at threeords.com.